Okay, we continue our study of David, the king who is the type of Christ, and we are beginning with the fourth chapter of 2 Samuel. We're meeting now Ishbosheth. Ishbosheth is a son of Saul who is reigning not very firmly in Israel. For 7.5 years coming up, David has been ruling in Judah, and he'll soon be ruling in all of Israel. But here begins the story of David actually becoming king. When Ishbosheth, son of Saul, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost courage, and all Israel became alarmed. So he's afraid. Now Saul's son had two men who were leaders of raiding bands. One was named Baanah, and the other Rechab. They were sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, that's the way we should say that, from the tribe of Benjamin. Beeroth is considered part of Benjamin because the people of Beeroth fled to Gittaim and have lived there as aliens to this day. Jonathan, son of Saul, had a son who was lame in both feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel that they had died in battle. His nurse picked him up and fled, but as she hurried to leave, he fell and became crippled. So he might have not simply fallen out of her arms, he might have fallen down an embankment or who knows what. We don't know what happened. But he was injured and he remained crippled. His name was Mephibosheth. So we've got Ishbosheth and Mephibosheth. And I think the chronicler he's going to talk about Ishbosheth, but he doesn't want any confusion about Mephibosheth because that's going to come up in down the line here a little bit. Now Rechab and Baanah, the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, set out for the house of Ishbosheth, and they arrived there in the heat of the day while he was taking his noonday rest. They went into the inner part of the house as if to get some wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and his brother Baanah slipped away. So because of this weak time, they're going to become heroes. You know, here's our opportunity. We'll kill Ishbosheth, and then we'll be heroes to David. They had gone into the house while he was lying on the bed in his bedroom. After they stabbed and killed him, they cut off his head. Taking it with them, they traveled all night by way of the Arabah. That's the valley of the Jordan and into the Dead Sea. They brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said to the king, "Here is the head of Ishbosheth, son of Saul, your enemy, who tried to take your life." Saul meaning Saul. "This day the Lord has avenged my lord the king against Saul and his offspring." So they know that David is a religious, spiritual man, and so they say, "Well, the Lord has done this," you know, this thing. David answered Rechab and his brother Baanah, the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, "As surely as the Lord lives, who has delivered me out of all trouble, when a man told me Saul is dead and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and put him to death in Ziklag. That was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more when wicked men have killed an innocent man in his own house and on his own bed, should I not now demand his blood from your hand and rid the earth of you?" So David gave an order to his men and they killed them. They cut off their hands and feet and hung the bodies by the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in Abner's tomb in Hebron. So a sad tale, but David hangs in there. All the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "We are your own flesh and blood. In the past, while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel on their military campaigns. And the Lord said to you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become their ruler.'" So they all knew that that was what Samuel, or what God had intended through Samuel. When all the elders of Israel had come to King David at Hebron, the king made a compact with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he became king. Now, they anointed him. That's not necessarily a disrespect for Samuel anointing him king. That's a public recognition that he's king. That's like crowning the king. David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years, 7.5 over Judah, and then 33 years over Israel and Judah. In Hebron, he reigned over 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judah 33 years. The king and his men marched to Jerusalem to attack the Jebusites. So the chronicler wants to tell us about Jerusalem. The Jebusites live in Jerusalem, and David is going to make Jerusalem his capital. Now that's an important part of the story, because from here on, I mean, we're looking forward to the new Jerusalem. So they marched to attack the Jebusites who lived there. The Jebusites said to David, "You will not get in here. Even the blind and lame can ward you off. Our city is so secure that we can have crippled and blind people defend, and you know, you won't be able to do anything." They thought, "David cannot get in here." Nevertheless, David captured the fortress of Zion, the city of David. In Chronicles, we find out that David offered a reward to anyone who could get in. And it sounds like let's keep on going, then we'll see that. On that day, David said, "Anyone who conquers the Jebusites will have to use the water shaft to reach those lame and blind who are David's enemies." So what they had was a horizontal tunnel that ran from the spring of Gihon, Gusher, to a pool. This is all underneath Jerusalem. And there was a shaft going down so they could lower buckets down into that pool, and they'd have a secure water supply. You couldn't not starve them out, but drive them out with thirst, because they had a permanent supply of water. David knows about this. Well, who knows how or why or what? No details. The chronicler doesn't tell us. And he says, this is the way you're going to get in there.
Isn't it awesome? I remember from way back when the people that were guarding that town, where they had crippled soldiers guarding the tunnel.
Yeah.
That he actually came in through the tunnel.
Well, and likely someone came in and opened the gates. I mean, I don't know. Or maybe a whole group of people went in and attacked them. But it's not too tough against the blind and the lame. Okay. David then took up residence in the fortress and called it the City of David. So this is now Zion. We know it as Mount Zion is one of the names. So he built up the area around it from the supporting terraces inward. So he made it even more stronger by building it up in. So it's an impregnable fortress. And he became more and more powerful because the Lord God Almighty was with him. So the chronicler is telling us what's happening. This is all not happening in 15 minutes, or 2.5 days after he conquered Jerusalem. The process of David establishing his reign in Israel is being described, and for the next chapters. Now Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David along with cedar logs and carpenters and stonemasons, and they built a palace for David. So Hiram is throwing his lot in with David. He sees David as a growing power in the area. And David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel and had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. David didn't get carried away with expanding his power. That's what that verse is saying. He knew that it was the Lord acting for the sake of the people that he was to rule over. After that's pretty good. Next is not so hot. After he left Hebron, moves to Jerusalem, David took more concubines and wives in Jerusalem, and more sons and daughters were born to him. These are the names of the children born to him there: Shammuah, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon, Ibhar, Elishua, Nepheg, Japhia, Elishama, Eliada, and Eliphelet. So it's names like Bill and David and John, George. All right. Okay, Solomon's in there, though, we notice. Okay. When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, they went up in full force to search for him. Now, again, the chronicler is not telling us a chronological story. This thing with Hiram, for example, these are all just facts. And the chronicler does not want to dwell on all the little details of David assuming political power. He just wants to record them. So it's one thing after the other, not necessarily coming in chronological order, but simply telling us what's occurring. So the Philistines are worried. Everybody's worried about David. So they say, well, we better strike early, because the longer he goes, the more powerful he will become. We're not told that, but that's the sensible thing. Now, the Philistines had come and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. That is very close to Bethlehem, south of Jerusalem. So they've come up from the sea. That's where, you know, on the Mediterranean Sea. And they've arrayed themselves in battle in the valley of Rephaim. So David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go and attack the Philistines? Will you hand them over to me?" Again, the ephod, you know, he goes and inquires of the Lord. The Lord answered him, "Go, for I will surely hand the Philistines over to you." So David went to Baal Perazim, which means, it's about breaking out, the Lord who breaks out. Now, Baal is still at this point possibly simply a word for a god, any god. Later on in the days of Elijah and Elisha, it will be a specific name for a false god. And there he defeated them. So it could be that they named the place, or it was known, especially by the Philistines and other Gentiles, as the place where the god breaks out, meaning the god of Israel.
I have a question.
Yeah.
It says the Lord says, "Go." Told David to go after the Philistines. How do we know today to go after the bad guys? With our war machine.
You mean our nation, America?
Yeah.
We don't have a clue. You have to use your head.
Wish we did.
Well, I mean, there's no direction in the Bible. I mean, there is no correspondence between Israel, the people of God, and America. The people of God are all the Christians everywhere. The national lines have nothing to do with it. But that wasn't the case in David's day. So, I guess today in the White House you flip a coin. I don't know. You know. But I would worry about anybody who thought God was on his side in politics. So, but there's no relation between what David is doing as the Lord's anointed over his people and any nation today, including our own. So, all right. As waters break out, so that's the Lord breaks out like a flood. As waters break out, the Lord has broken out against my enemies before me. So that place was called Baal Perazim. So pretty clearly that word Baal there is, and maybe it isn't the word that David would have used possibly, but that was what it became known as. Who knows? But later on, when you're talking Elijah and Elisha, Baal is never used about God. The Philistines abandoned their idols there, and David and his men carried them up. So it was such a rout, they brought their idols in wheelbarrows. I always think about this. Isaiah says, you know, you have to cart your gods around in wheelbarrows. And then it was such a rout that they lost their idols. Too. So all the gold starts to go. David is beginning to save up for the temple. Once more the Philistines came up and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. Now, again, this might be, maybe it was 3 years separated. I mean, it's just telling us that twice the Philistines lined up against David and they thought they could handle it. So David inquired of the Lord and he answered, "Do not go straight up. but circle around behind them and attack them in front of the balsam trees. So in you search in vain in Israel today for trees. I mean, they've planted trees. There are trees there. But over the centuries since the time of David, the trees were all cut down. That certainly affected the land. But they're there now. So he's to circle around. They're lined up in the valley, perhaps on one side, because you'd want the high ground. Mm-hmm. But at the top would be the balsam trees, and the Lord tells David, circle around behind. And attack them in front of the balsam trees. Now, that's not a particularly good strategy. Because, now, again, we haven't seen the situation, but if you're attacking through the woods, you're setting yourself up for problems. But it doesn't make any difference here. The Lord is telling him what to do. And so he says, the Lord says, as soon as you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, move quickly, because that will mean that the Lord has gone out in front of you to strike the Philistine army. And boy, all kinds of, if you read commentators, they're trying to figure out some explanation of this that won't have anything to do with the Lord or be miraculous. And it gets pretty strange. Hearing the sound of marching in the balsam trees.
Yeah.
What's clear, so David did as the Lord commanded him, and he struck down the Philistines all the way from Gibeon to Gezer. I think the simplest explanation is that God sent an army of angels ahead of him. This is a divine victory.
Because how could you march in the tops of the trees?
Well, you're only hearing the sound of marching, but yeah, the angels wouldn't have any trouble with that. All right. So David's feeling his oats, and he's a spiritual guy, and he wants the ark to be in Jerusalem. The religion of Israel has declined precipitously. It was bad enough at the end of the period of the judges, because it went downhill during that whole period, and in Samuel's day, and Saul did nothing to improve things. So we, as David moves the ark, we'll hear the story, he apparently sets up a tent. So it's possible that the tabernacle is in such disrepair or ruin that it isn't even being used, and we don't even know where it was for sure. It's been in different places. But all the things are spread all over the place, and of course the ark is the most important thing. It's the presence of God among the children of Israel. So David again brought together out of Israel chosen men, 30,000 in all. He and all his men set out from Baalah of Judah to bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by the name. The name of the Lord Almighty, Yahweh, or Yahovah, but Yahweh. I am who I am. Who is enthroned between the cherubim that are on the ark. So this is the throne of God. And everything that the children of Israel knew about the throne of God told them what? Stay away. Remember how the tabernacle was set up and only the priests and Levites were to participate. Because we think, and David did too, that God acts rather arbitrarily here. They set the ark of God on a new cart. Now that's offensive. What does that remind you of? Remember when, where had the ark been?
The Philistines.
And they brought it on an ox cart, and that was offensive.
And this basically is against the rule that the Levites had. They were to hand carry that ark.
Right. And so what lesson is David going to learn, or what did he forget, and what lesson is he going to learn? He needs to do what the Lord instructed him to do, not what David wanted to do, whether his motives were correct or not. Don't mess with God. So they set the ark of God on a new cart and brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart with the ark of God on it, and Ahio was walking in front of it. Good for him. David and the whole house of Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord with songs and harps, lyres, tambourines, sistrums, and cymbals. So all the instruments, and they're having a very good time. And there's nothing bad. I mean, there was anything wrong with them celebrating, except that they didn't do it the way that God had prescribed. And David knew better. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark of God. Well, a threshing floor is clay, you know, wet and smoothed out and then dried and swept off. You sweep off the dust and you get something like concrete. I mean, it's hard. And there you can thresh the grain. And so that's permanently there. Well, a threshing floor would typically be raised or be part of an area where you can throw, I mean, after you thresh the grain, you want to toss it in the air, winnow it. So it's not even. Nobody has any idea what it looked like. But the suggestion is, well, when the cart was going up on the threshing floor would be flat, but nearby wouldn't. So who knows? I mean, you know, we just don't know. But the cart tips back and forth. Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark of God because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore, God struck him down, and he died there beside the ark of God. So there was the slightest doubt about what had happened. And remember, how should David have known to do it differently? Well, first he would know from the history of Israel, wouldn't he? I mean, but also on the ark were what?
Rings.
So that you could put the poles through and the priests could carry it. What's this ox bit? See? And where are the priests? Well, David had a little problem. Well, see, it's hard to judge David's motives. God doesn't seem to judge his motives. He just judges what's happening. So we can speculate about what David did think or not think. What we have is the story. Okay, and so and he died there. Then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah. Well, we can speculate about why would he be angry?
I just want to bring you to my house. I was just trying to do what I thought was right.
And when God killed Uzzah, who looks bad? David. You know, he's looking bad. So he's angry first. David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah. And to this day, that place is called Perez Uzzah, the breaking out to Uzzah. David was afraid. That's an interesting word, too, by the way, breaking out. The Lord broke out. Well, that'd be interesting. He didn't want to be there when that happened. And now, first David's angry, but then, verse 9, David was afraid of the Lord that day. I think he thought a little better. How can the ark of the Lord ever come to me? So now we get a little passive-aggressive behavior. I want the ark of the covenant to be in Jerusalem, but how is this ever going to happen? Because nobody is going to go near it, including me. I'm not. I'm learning my lesson. So, what am I supposed to do? He was not willing to take the ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David, because he was afraid. Instead, he took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, which, and you get the feeling that they just parked it in the nearest possible spot. Maybe somebody tied a rope to the noses of the oxen and got 50 feet away and led them. I don't know what happened, but they parked it right there. David's not taking any more chances. The ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, for 3 months. And the Lord blessed him and his entire household. Everything is going... And that makes you think of what? What happened the last place the ark was? When it was in the towns of Philistia, it was one terrible thing after another. You know, so we see this contrast. And David does too. Now, King David was told, the Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the ark of God. It's harvest time, and his harvest is 3 times larger than everybody else's. I mean, I don't know what's happening. Wonderful things are happening for... I don't imagine that Obed-Edom was real happy about the ark leaving, but... So David went down and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. So David decides that God's will is still good and that this will work, but he's real careful. When those who were carrying the ark, little change in plans there, no ox.
Right.
When they had taken 6 steps, didn't get to the 7th step, 6 steps they stop, and David, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all his might, while he and the entire house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. One of the psalm refrains, I can't remember, with shouts and the sound of trumpets going up. As the ark of the Lord was entering the city, yes.
Yeah. When we read the words, the ark was brought up, does that, will that usually mean, always mean that they were carrying the ark?
Look at verse 13, that's the answer there.
Yeah, they carried it.
Yes.
But when they brought the ark, we read that as though the priests are carrying it.
Sure, because of the verse before, though, not because of the word. I mean, it says they were carrying it. They stopped after 6 steps, had a sacrifice, and held their breath. But they were doing what was right, and so far as they could. There is no tabernacle, you know. So when it says they brought it up, means they got it up there, and because it says before that they were carrying it, that's your answer. It isn't in the word brought up. Okay. As the ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And Michal loved David, remember at the beginning, things have cooled. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. Now, sometimes people have looked at this and said that David embarrassed himself. But I don't think that there's any reason to believe that. There is no reason to believe anything other than that David was rejoicing in the Lord. And Michal just didn't like it. She thought it was unbecoming a king. The children of Israel were very demonstrative in their entire history. I mean, somebody dies in Jesus' day and the women wail. You know, the women would all come over, and some of them may be wailing because they are feeling the loss, but some of them may come to wail because it's a way of supporting and showing their sympathy and care. They're very demonstrative. Tearing your clothes. You know, the high priest tears his clothes to show how unhappy he is. Well, if a politician did that, he would make it very far. What was the... There was one up in the... I don't know if it was New Hampshire, but I think it was up there. Season of the primaries, and I'm trying to remember who it was, but he got a little emotional.
In Iowa.
Oh, was it in Iowa? Okay.
He lost the nomination.
Yeah, he was done because he had wept. You know, if you're a leader, you got to have a stiff upper lip. Well, it's different in the Middle East. It still is today. All right, so what happened? They brought the Ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And there's no indication that that was the old tabernacle. It's possible, but I don't know that you would say that a tent David had pitched was the tabernacle.
But how many years is this from the time that Moses, it's like 500
years? 1,400 years, it's 400 years. 1,400 B.C., David is about 1,000.
Okay, so I was thinking maybe about 500. You know, that tent probably had long since disintegrated.
Well, that's possible. And but it just, it's not spoken of. Okay, so what happened? David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, King James peace offerings, before the Lord. Fellowship offerings are the offerings that say that God is holy, I'm sinful. I cannot come into his presence. And therefore, because I am sinful and the wages of sin is death, but the animal dies. That's from that thin line, that thin red line goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. And so that's what those offerings are about. He blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Now, where are the priests? You know, where are the priests? What is David doing? You know, it's kind of hard to tell. I think that probably the best way to interpret it is to say that everything had deteriorated so badly that David needed to pull everything together, and there simply weren't people to do this properly. On the other hand, the New Testament talks about the royal priesthood. And there are things in the scripture that combine the king and the priest. So probably things we don't understand. Then, verse 19, then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd of Israelites, both men and women. And all the people went to their homes. That would seem to be a substitution for the sacrifices that would have been eaten. Although that's, you know, there's too much guessing there. See, normally you would bring... But there aren't enough animals. They're just the whole worship of the Lord is so disorganized that they can't even do it in the ordinary way. So my guess is that loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person was a way to have them participate in what was happening, because the normal way prescribed by Moses, they're simply not prepared to do it. So all the people went to their homes. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today." You know, okay, so bitter sarcasm here. "Disrobing in the sight of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would." And I remember people talking about, well, apparently David danced naked. That's taking Michael's word. He's taken off the kingly robes and he's dancing in this linen ephod, and she thinks it's beneath him. You know, he's just become an ordinary person. So she says, "Disrobing in the sight of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would." So who knows? David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord." So, okay, Michal, you got your problems with your loyalty to the house of Saul, and, the ardor has cooled, shall we say. "I will become even more undignified than this." You think that was bad? "And I will be humiliated in my own eyes." I have no problem humbling myself before the Lord. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor. So, you know, so again, there's just no indication that David did anything that was improper. And Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. And the chronicler just notes that without any other comment. Yeah. So, don't touch arks and don't pick on the king. All right, chapter 7. God's promise to David. Now, this is critical. David is beginning his reign. He, by the time we're at chapter 11, which is coming fairly quickly, because between here and chapter 11, chapter 11 is the beginning of the story of David and Bathsheba. So that's not a very good thing. This is a very important chapter. After the king was settled in his palace and the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies around him. So how far is this into his reign? He's defeated the Ammonites to the west, to the east, and the Philistines to the west, and he's made a treaty, an agreement with Hiram up to the north. Things are going well. So it's like a general, you know, everything's going well and he's settled down. He said to Nathan the prophet, "Here I am living in a palace of cedar." Well, how many years did it take to use Hiram's cedar logs and craftsmen and stone and cedar, you know? That, by the way, that's technological advancement. Because if you make something purely out of stone, you're limited in how much you can bridge. So, for instance, if you went to the Parthenon in Greece, but Athens, inside of those temples are columns, rows of columns of stone, because you can only put so much stone across there, otherwise the weight will break it. But these cedars of Lebanon were gigantic. They're all gone. That's like our redwoods, you know. But cedars would be much stronger, and you could build grander buildings by coming up with stone and then bridging with cedar for a roof. All right, so that's important. But here I am living in a palace of cedar while the Ark of God remains in a tent. Nathan replied to the king, "Whatever you have in mind, go ahead and do it, for the Lord is with you." Now, that was not a word from the Lord. That was a word from Nathan. But he thought that, you know, David has the favor of the Lord, and this seems like a reasonable thing to do. That night, the word of the Lord came to Nathan, saying, "Go and tell my servant David, this is what the Lord says." Now, as we go along, you need to think, why did the Lord cut David off from building the temple? "This is what the Lord says." Now, this is God speaking to Nathan. "Are you the one to build me a house to dwell in? I have not dwelt in a house from the day I brought the Israelites up out of Egypt to this day. I have been moving from place to place with a tent as my dwelling. So I'm like my people. You know, I am a wandering Aramean. Wherever I have moved with all the Israelites, did I ever say to any of their rulers whom I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, 'Why have you not built me a house of cedar?' Now then, tell my servant David, this is what the Lord Almighty says. I took you from the pasture and from following the flock to be ruler over my people Israel." So to really be a shepherd not of sheep, but of people. "I have been with you wherever you have gone, and I have cut off all your enemies from before you. Now I will make your name great, like the names of the greatest men of the earth. And I will provide a place for my people Israel, and will plant them so that they can have a home of their own and no longer be disturbed. Wicked people will not oppress them anymore as they did at the beginning and have done ever since the time I appointed leaders over my people Israel. I will also give you rest from all your enemies. So those are all good things, aren't they? And what does this remind you of? What is God telling David, particularly in verse 9 and 10? He's making him a promise. What promise does it remind you of? It isn't in the words, but the thrust of the promise is the same as the one that God made to
Abraham,
right? Okay, now, but why is God cutting him off from building this temple? And remember, he says, I didn't need a temple. You know, all right. The Lord declares to you, let's keep on going. The Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, who will come from your own body, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son. When he does wrong, I will punish him with the rod of men, with floggings inflicted by men. But my love will never be taken away from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. Nathan reported to David all the words of this entire revelation. Now, I believe that this word of the Lord to David came late in his reign. I do not have any confidence, for example, that it came before the thing with David and Bathsheba. Because as the chroniclers tell the story, they tell you what they want you to know. They don't necessarily tell a chronological story. So within each story, there is chronology, and it's possible. But notice that David would have been greatly comforted because God pointed him to whom? Besides the Lord himself.
His offspring.
That would be... No.
Solomon.
So...
It was also beyond that.
Oh, absolutely. But I'm just pointing out that he's pointing him to Solomon as the one who's going to do this. Well, is this an 8-year-old Solomon? See, I think that this happened a time later. It doesn't change the story. It can be whenever. But it is important to be able to read Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles without worrying too much. Now, when you get into Kings and Chronicles, it gets much more chronological because it's one king after the other. But within that, the stories don't necessarily come within each king's reign chronologically, and you have to get used to that. Did you add? Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a prophecy of Christ or the Messiah in verse 14?
Let me look at what 14. I will be his father. No.
No. He speaks about the wrong, and I will punish him.
I will punish him with the rod of men.
Yeah.
Well, why would he punish Christ?
Well,
when he does wrong, I will punish him.
I'm thinking here of Solomon. Was Solomon?
Oh, yes.
He was?
God is saying, when he goes off, I'll punish him with the rod of men. He'll lose victories. He'll have problems. The kingdom split right after Solomon. So God is going to do that. The prophecy of Christ has been coming all along in type, but then when you get to verse 16, there it is. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. Well, that can only really be fulfilled in Christ. So Nathan reports everything to David. Now, again, why does God not permit David to build his house, the temple? I have always heard, and I think there's probably, I'm not sure what the point is, and it may be that I just can't remember it, that David's reign was a bloody reign, and that he was a man of warfare.
Well, it states that in the scriptures.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember where, though. I can't. Yeah, okay. So that's what I was saying. That's what's been said. But in this verse, there's something else here. And what it is that God is saying to David, your service of me and your reputation for all of history will not depend on you building me this house. Your son's going to do that. But your reign will be forever. Your kingdom and your house, that's the word I was trying to think of, will endure forever. That's the thing that's most important. Not building this building. So Solomon's going to build a building. Now, if I could, I don't think we see it here, and it may be that when we get to Solomon later on, that the transition from David to Solomon, that's where it's set. But I think we need to see this here. God is telling David, you're like, why did Abram leave the Mesopotamian Valley and civilization and go to no place in Canaan? Because God told him, I will make you a great nation, and you will affect all of history. Everybody's ultimate fate will depend on their relationship to you. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. So that's important here, regardless of whether David is a man of with blood on his hands. So David's prayer. Then David went in and sat before the Lord, which means he went into the tent and sat in front of the Ark of the Covenant. And he said, who am I, O Sovereign Lord, and what is my family that you have brought me this far? So, there is nothing. This is an admission that he has not done anything, that God has done it. And as if this were not enough in your sight, O Sovereign Lord, you have also spoken about the future of the house of your servant. Not only have you brought me to this point, you've told me this wonderful promise. So, was David disappointed? Well, no doubt he was. But we don't hear it here. He recognizes the promise that Nathan brought, the promise of the Lord that Nathan brought to him. Is this your usual way of dealing with man, O Sovereign Lord? What? That's a rhetorical question, which expects what answer? No, this is not. You don't usually do such wonderful things. Why have you done this to me? What more can David say to you? For you know your servant, O Sovereign Lord. For the sake of your word and according to your will, you have done this great thing and made it known to your servant. So if this is really happening, this exchange between David and Nathan after Bathsheba and Uriah, then David is once again confessing that he is unworthy. How great you are, O Sovereign Lord! There is no one like you, there is no God but you, as we have heard with our own ears. And who is like your people Israel? See, that's better then. And who is like your King David? See, never. Rulers tend to identify the country with themselves. That's not good. I won't get into politics here. And to make a name for himself. And who is like your people Israel, the one nation on earth that God went out to redeem as a people for himself and to make a name for himself? God is making a name by his loving care to his people. Do they deserve that? All the time that the Lord was doing this, he had to hold his nose. And David was no different, nor was Solomon. Okay, and to perform great and awesome wonders by driving out nations and their gods from before your people, whom you redeemed from Egypt. So from the days of Egypt till defeating the Philistines with the sound of marching in the balsam trees. You have established your people Israel as your very own forever, and you, O Lord, have become their God. They didn't choose God, God chose them. And now, Lord God, keep forever the promise you have made concerning your servant and his house. Do as you promised, so that your name will be great forever. So you've made this decision. I accept the fact that I'm not going to build the temple. Carry out the blessings and promise that you intend. Then men will say, the Lord Almighty is God over Israel, and the house of your servant David will be established before you. O Lord Almighty, God of Israel, you have revealed this to your servant, saying, I will build a house for you. I don't want you to build a house for me. I will establish your house forever. So your servant has found courage to offer you this prayer. I'm bold to come before you. This is a very beautiful prayer. O sovereign Lord, you are God. And what do we notice about this prayer? You know, people today talk in the strangest terms about prayer. People say, well, if you really want the Lord to answer, you need to pray. Cast yourself down before him and pray for hours. Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But you better concentrate on what you pray. That's the thing. And look at what David is telling us. I mean, this is like a Bible class, you know, this prayer. It's telling us what our attitude toward the Lord should be. He is reflecting on the greatness of God and what that means for him. He isn't asking God for anything other than God promised him. And he says he only sort of obliquely, you know, says something about the fact that God told him he couldn't build a house. It's there, but you have to read it carefully. And if you didn't know that God said he shouldn't build the house, then you wouldn't even see it. All right. Your words are trustworthy, and you have promised these good things to your servant. Now be pleased to bless the house of your servant, that it may continue forever in your sight. I'm going to go forward in this faith. Because you are going to be pleased to do that. For you, O sovereign Lord, have spoken, and with your blessing, the house of your servant will be blessed forever. All right, chapter 8 is a listing by the chronicler of all the victories of David. This is another reason why we're not looking as if this were chronological. These are all the victories that David won during his reign. In David's day, this would have been the most important chapter that people would have thought. You know, you list the glories of the king, all of his victories. The chronicler makes short work of them. Okay? Because the history of the children of Israel from Exodus, Genesis too, but Exodus to the time of Jesus Christ, is not the typical history of a nation at all. It is absolutely unique. There is nothing like it in history because it's about God. It's not about the particular king of Israel here, David. It's not about the people of Israel. It's about the Lord. So let's skip 8. Verse 15, we won't quite skip it. Verse 15, David reigned over all Israel, doing what was just and right for all his people. Joab, son of Zeruiah, was over the army. Jehoshaphat, son of Ahilud, was recorder. Zadok, son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, son of Abiathar, were priests. Zadok and Ahimelech. Seraiah was secretary. Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, was over the Kerethites and the Pelethites. And David's sons were royal advisors. The possibility of priests, I didn't study that. Advisors rather than priests, I'm not sure about that. I just realized that would have been a good thing to look into and I missed that. What? Yeah, it says or priests, right.
Or
I mean, the word could be used that way, but what would be the considerations that would make the NIV choose advisors over priests? Because they're David's sons,
They weren't Levites,
yeah. And that's reasonable. Yes?
Zadok was the most prominent priest here mentioned, isn't he? He's mentioned later.
We don't in Samuel get as much of a story about all the things that David did for the worship of Israel as we do in Kings, but especially Chronicles. I think Chronicles. David organized everything. I mean, he really threw himself into getting the priests ready. So, okay, I'm not going to build this temple, but when I'm gone, Solomon's going to build the temple and everything will be ready. The priests, the music, the Levites were organized into clans and each assigned different things. There are all kinds of things. And David wrote half of the Psalms that are written in the book of Psalms. So, you know, all right. But here we're getting the history. All right, now a little story about David and Mephibosheth, again to tell us how faithful David was. And he wasn't an ordinary ruler, because the first thing an ordinary ruler would do would be to kill all the possible people who could claim a place on the throne. So David asked, "Is there anyone still left in the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" When did he ask this? There's not a single indication. Mm-hmm. I would suggest that this was probably fairly early in his reign, not much later. But it's just a story that the chronicler tells us. "Now there was a servant of Saul's household named Ziba. They called him to appear before David, and the king said to him, 'Are you Ziba?' So somebody said, 'You know, there is somebody, and this is the guy who knows.' 'Are you Ziba?' 'Your servant,' he replied," meaning, "Yes, I am. I'm your servant." The king asked, "Is there no one still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show God's kindness?" Ziba answered the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in both feet." "Where is he?" the king asked. Ziba answered, "He is at the house of Machir, son of Amiel in Lo Debar." That's an interesting name. Lo means not, like Lo Ami. That's one of the names later on of the children that Hosea bears. Not my people. Ami, not my people. Lo Ami, not my people. Lo Debar means no pasture. So this wasn't a particularly great place to be. It was named No Pasture. So I don't know. When Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. David said, "Mephibosheth, your servant," he replied. "Don't be afraid," David said to him, "for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table." So you're part of the household, and the private properties that belong to Saul, David restores to Mephibosheth. So it was a great day. Come on down. Mephibosheth bowed down and said, "What is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me?" So he really putting himself down, humbling himself before the king. Then the king summoned Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, "I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family, and I'm instructing you to make sure that he gets it. You and your sons and your servants are to farm the land for him and bring in the crops so that your master's grandson may be provided for, and Mephibosheth, grandson of your master, will always eat at my table." So if you got any suggestions that you might get rid of the young son here or something, and maybe I'm, you know, maybe I'm giving Ziba a hard time here. At any rate, David makes it clear what is to happen. Am I clear? Crystal. All right. Then Ziba said to the king, "Your servant will do whatever my lord the king commands his servant to do." So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. Now, no doubt he ate at the table, but this is also similar, like the butler in the king's house isn't simply a butler. He holds an office. And so eating at the king's table doesn't simply mean that he ate every meal with David every night or something like that, but rather that he was a part of the household. So a favored position, like one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah, and all the members of Ziba's household were servants of Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table. That's where he was. And he was crippled in both feet. So once again, his inability to really rule in David's place is emphasized because David was so magnanimous toward him. All right, the enemies to the east. In the course of time, the king of the Ammonites died, and his son Hanun succeeded him as king. David thought, I will show kindness to Hanun, son of Nahash. Nahash and David had not gotten along well, just as his father showed kindness to me. So they made a standoff. They made a pact. So David sent a delegation to express his sympathy to Hanun concerning his father. So the Ammonites never got along with Israel and didn't get along with David either. And we can see that in this story that's coming up. But there was peace. When David's men came to the land of the Ammonite nobles said to Hanun, their lord, do you think David is honoring your father by sending men to you to express sympathy? So, you know, do you think this? And I would suspect that this story was fairly early, because clearly the Ammonites can't be a problem on his eastern flank. And David established peace. So I think this is fairly early on. So his advisors say, look out, you got to watch out. Hasn't David sent them to you to explore the city and spy it out and overthrow it? So, you know, we don't want to show them anything because they may see some weak points, or they get to assess what it will take to attack them and so forth, to spy it out and overthrow it. So Hanun seized David's men, shaved off half of each man's beard, cut off their garments in the middle at the buttocks, and sent them away. So he's embarrassing him. I mean, this is really, this is war. So he's feeling his oats, Hanun is. He thinks he can take David. When David was told about this, he sent messengers to meet the men. So somebody goes ahead of them, and they don't hardly want to return because it's so embarrassing. So David sends men out. They were greatly humiliated. The king said, stay at Jericho till your beards have grown and then come back. So, okay, this happened to you, but, you know, what in the world were you going to do? You know, there wasn't anything. So David is telling his men, you know, it's okay. When the Ammonites realized that they had become a stench in David's nostrils, they hired 20,000 Aramean foot soldiers. That was their ace in the hole. 20,000 Aramean foot soldiers. Arameans, you know, Abraham called himself a wandering Aramean. That's a reference to all those Bedouin tribes. So they're mercenaries. He hires an army. From Beth Rehob and Zobah, as well as the king of Maacah with 1,000 men, and also 12,000 men from Tob. On hearing this, David sent Joab out with the entire army of fighting men. The Ammonites came out and drew up in battle formation at the entrance to their city gate, while the Arameans of Zobah and Rehob and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the open country. So they're behind the city walls, but the army is out there. Joab saw that there were battle lines in front of him and behind him. See, that's the problem. So he selected some of the best troops in Israel and deployed them against the Arameans. He put the rest of the men under the command of Abishai, his brother, and deployed them against the Ammonites. Joab said, if the Arameans are too strong for me, then you are to come to my rescue. But if the Ammonites are too strong for you, he's telling Abishai, then I will come to rescue you. Be strong and let us fight bravely for our people in the cities of our God. The Lord will do what is good in his sight. Then Joab and the troops with him advanced to fight the Arameans, and they fled before him. When the Ammonites saw that the Arameans were fleeing, they fled before Abishai and went inside the city. So he's up in front of the gates, but the army is lined up. Well, now they retreat. So Joab returned from fighting the Ammonites and came to Jerusalem. After the Arameans saw that they had been routed by Israel, they regrouped. Hadad-Ezer had Arameans brought from beyond the river. That's what?
Jordan?
No.
The Nile?
The river, no. Only one left.
The Euphrates.
More from the east. They went to Helam with Shobach, the commander of Hadadezer's army, leading them. When David was told of this, he gathered all Israel across the Jordan and went to Helam. The Arameans formed their battle lines to meet David and fought against him, but they fled before Israel, and David killed 700 of their charioteers and 40,000 of their foot soldiers. He also struck down Shobach, the commander of their army, and he died there. When all the kings who were vassals of Hadadezer saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with the Israelites and became subject to them. So Hadadezer, David's kingdom is stretching out now to the east. So the Arameans were afraid to help the Ammonites anymore. All right. Now, so much for all the politics and the battles and so forth, and that goes quite quickly. But the chronicler really wants us to tell us about spiritual things. So here we are. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war. Now the spring doesn't relate to any year. It isn't at all necessarily the spring of the year right after this. It's just in the spring, because in the spring kings go off to war. You don't fight in the winter because too many problems with mud and rain and cold and whatever else. So it's time for war. What are we told? David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained in Jerusalem. He's getting a little soft. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Meaning, that's who I think you were seeing. Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. He's the king. This is a difficult situation. She had purified herself from her uncleanness. Now, why is that mentioned? Well, maybe David tells us that he's not going to have relations with her when she's menstruating. But it also tells us that she's likely to get pregnant. Right. Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David saying, "I am pregnant." Well, she's married, so that wouldn't normally be a problem, except... So David sent this word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite, quick." And when Joab sent him to David, when Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab was. Got to have a reason for Uriah, an officer, coming. So how's Joab doing? How the soldiers were and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. You know, enjoy yourself at home with your wife. So Uriah left the palace, and a gift from the king was sent after him. But Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all his master's servants and did not go down to his house. Uriah's a soldier, and he's not going to enjoy some R&R while all his soldiers are fighting. It's embarrassing. Everything that's happening here is, this is not looking good for David at all. Mm-hmm. When David was told Uriah did not go home, he asked him, "Haven't you just come from a distance? Why didn't you go home?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my master Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open fields. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing." David's enjoying himself. Okay. Then David said to him, stay here one more day, and tomorrow I will send you back. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. Whoops, so this is not going to work. At David's invitation, he ate and drank with him, and David made him drunk. But in the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat among his master's servants. He did not go home. So another attempt. Maybe if he's got a little tipsy, he'll head home. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. This is wicked. In it he wrote, put Uriah in the front line where the fighting is fiercest. Then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die. So while Joab had the city under siege, he put Uriah at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were. When the men of the city came out and fought against Joab, some of the men in David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite was dead. So just exactly what Joab and David had planned happened. Joab sent David a full account of the battle. He instructed the messenger, when you have finished giving the king this account of the battle, the king's anger may flare up, and he may ask you, why did you get so close to the city to fight? Why did you make this strategic error? Or tactical, not strategic. Tactical error. Didn't you know they would shoot arrows from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal-Besheth? Didn't a woman throw an upper millstone? That's a story. The son of Gideon. Didn't a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died in Thebes? Remember that? You don't get too close to the wall because bad things happen. Why did you get so close to the wall? If he asks you this, then say to him, also your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead. So the guy's going to come back and he's going to recount what happened. Well, how come we lost men? And if he gets angry because they got too close, just mention that the Hittite too was killed. The messenger, and then David will know, we didn't make any tactical error. This was me carrying out your wicked command. The messenger set out, and when he arrived, he told David everything Joab had sent him to say. The messenger said to David, the men overpowered us and came out against us in the open, but we drove them back to the entrance to the city gate. Then the archers shot arrows at your servants from the wall, and some of the king's men died. Moreover, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead. David told the messenger, say this to Joab, don't let this upset you. The sword devours one as well as another. It's what happens. Press the attack against the city and destroy it. Say this to encourage Joab. When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. After the time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing David had done displeased the Lord. And as straightforward a story as you can get, no excuse, no varnishing over it. It's just straightforward in all its ugliness. The Lord sent Nathan to David. Now, according to David's Psalms, David spent a long time away from the Lord because of this. Now, exactly how long is hard to say. People have guessed a year or even 18 months. I can't remember exactly what that's based on, but it's not certain. But David, and there's good belief that David never went to the Ark of the Covenant, to the tent where the Ark of the Covenant was. So David's conscience was bothering him. The hand of the Lord was resting on him. So, the Lord sent Nathan to David. When he came to him, he said, there were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one ewe lamb he had bought. Now, why is Nathan telling David this story? Not, I mean, you know why, but remember who Nathan is. He's the prophet of the Lord. So when he comes to David with this story, David is looking for a lesson, a message from the Lord. It's not just a cute little story from Nathan. This is, he comes as the priest of the, I mean, the prophet of the Lord. So it's a parable. And he had one ewe lamb he had bought. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food, drank from his cup, even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him, because hospitality is essential. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. Wow, David said, okay. David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die." Oh, I'm getting the message, Nathan, from the Lord here. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity. And then one of the most dramatic, painters, you know, there are wonderful paintings of Nathan, you know, pointing at David. Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you, and your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if all this had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his sight? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own." Well, there's a little bit of, you know, how much did this affect God's decision that he wouldn't build the temple? But you're always guessing. And don't get away from the idea that's in the text that the real promise to David was not that he would build the house of the Lord, but that the Lord would build his house. And so that's important. But you can imagine how devastating this is. I mean, there's no... you might tell this story from Nathan's point of view.
Kid, I wouldn't want to.
The Lord tells Nathan this, and go and tell him this. Okay, yes, sir. And he goes, you know, "Out of your own household I am going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you." Whose name was? Absalom. From your own household. And he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. We're going to see that happen. "You did it in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all Israel." And then Nathan's got it out, and then he ducks, I guess. I don't know. "Then David said to Nathan, 'I have sinned against the Lord.' Nathan replied, 'The Lord has taken away your sin.'" How did Nathan decide that? Well, the only reasonable reason is that the Lord had instructed him. You know, he's not making his own decisions. "The Lord has taken away your sin. You are not going to die. But because by doing this you have made the enemies of the Lord show utter contempt, the son born to you will die." The son that's born of Bathsheba. "After Nathan had gone home, the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife had borne to David, and he became ill. David pleaded with God for the child. 'Punish me, not the child.' He fasted and went into his house and spent the nights lying on the ground. The elders of his household stood beside him to get him up from the ground, but he refused, and he would not eat any food with them. On the seventh day, the child died. David's servants were afraid to tell him that the child was dead, for they thought, 'While the child was still living, we spoke to David, but he would not listen to us. How can we tell him the child is dead? He may do something desperate.'" So David is clearly a very emotional guy, which would have made Nathan pretty worried. But he goes nevertheless. And so they're worried about David. And he's a poet. You know, I mean, so David noticed that his servants were whispering among themselves, and he realized the child was dead. "Is the child dead?" he asked. "Yes," they replied, "he is dead." Then David got up from the ground after he had washed, put on lotions, and changed his clothes. He went into the house of the Lord and worshipped. And that's certainly one of the things that leads to the suggestion that he had not been going to the house of the Lord, which wasn't, of course, the temple, but was the tent, and worshipped. He's been forgiven, and the consequences have fallen. The death of that child occurred because David needed to realize the consequences of what he had done, and also that this child that was born of his sin was not going to be the means through which the Lord's promise to make his throne last forever would not go through this son. Let's see. He answered, his servants asked him, "Why are you acting this way?" He worshipped. Then he went to his own house, and at his request they served him food, and he ate. His servants asked him, "Why are you acting this way? While the child was alive, you fasted and wept. But now that the child is dead, you get up and eat." He answered, "While the child was still alive, I fasted and wept. I thought, who knows? The Lord may be gracious to me and let the child live. But now that he is dead, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I will go to him, but he will not return to me. So there's nothing I can do. I'm going to die, but he will not come back. I will go to him, but he will not return to me." Then David comforted his wife Bathsheba, and he went to her and lay with her. She gave birth to a son, and they named him Solomon. Now that's interesting, because we had Solomon before mentioned. Now, what are the two possibilities? Let's see, that was at the end. Where was that? Pretty close to where we began, huh?
Not in sequence.
Well, it depends on what the answer is, but yeah, that's... that's reasonable to say. Wait a minute.
One explanation: the first time it mentions the children of David.
Yeah.
No time sequence.
That's right. That's one possibility. And the other possibility, I think, less likely.
There could have been another Solomon.
There could have been two Solomon.
Yeah.
That's a possibility. But again, When the chronicler is just telling the story of what David did, he just gives the details. And so even though Solomon was important, it was nevertheless true. Is it chapter 4 at the end? I didn't get far.
Four.
Yeah. So they're all listed.
Yeah.
Yeah, children. So, well, I mean, we're not going to get an answer. So there we are. So what happened then? She gave birth to the name of Solomon. The Lord loved him, and because the Lord loved him, he sent word through Nathan the prophet to name him Jedidiah. So he's Solomon, but he's Jedidiah, loved by the Lord. And why would the Lord send word through Nathan the prophet to name him Jedidiah? Because the Lord wanted David to know
that this was the one.
Right. And that God had not departed from him. And this is the one, right? This is the one through whom your kingdom is to be continued. And I have not forsaken you, which David could have concluded. Meanwhile, Joab fought against Rabbah of the Ammonites, that city of Rabbah, and captured the royal citadel. Joab then sent messengers to David, "I fought against Rabbah and taken its water supply," which means we've got the city, because if we besiege it, we can just starve them out. They don't have water. "Now muster the rest of the troops and besiege the city and capture it. Otherwise, I will take the city and it will be named after me." Now, this, this is interesting. I think that these are bitter, sarcastic words from Joab. Because I think he's, you know, you know, this whole mess back there, David, not reflect well on you at all. And you should have been out here. Now come out here, because you should take lead the army in capturing the city. Otherwise, I'm going to, and they'll name it after me. So David mustered the entire army, went to Rabbah, and attacked and captured it. He took the crown from the head of their king. Its weight was a talent of gold, and it was set with precious stones, and it was placed on David's head. He took a great quantity of plunder from the city and brought out the people who were there, consigning them to labor with saws and with iron picks and axes, and he made them work at brick baking. He did this to all the Ammonite towns. Then David and his entire army returned to Jerusalem. So his eastern flank is secured with all of those victories. That's okay. 13, a good place to stop. Sad story here. We'll talk about that. And then we have the rebellion of Absalom coming up. So we should be able to... Ziba comes back again. Absalom dies. And so, all right. Now, schedule. We'll meet next Wednesday, but on the 21st of October, we pastors will be in North Hollywood for the district pastoral conference on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And then the Wednesday following that is when President Buchholz will be here to have an open forum with the congregation and learn from us how we're seeing our ministry and so forth. So we'll meet next Wednesday, and then we'll miss two. And then we'll resume in November for a brief time up to Thanksgiving.
Wednesday. To the end of the year.
Time. Yeah, time goes by. Yeah, Thanksgiving and Advent, right? Okay. President Buchholz has gone to every congregation that has called before calling except one.
Which one?
What?
President
Buchholz has gone to meet before the call with every congregation except
here. Which one?
No. Fresno, close. And that did not turn out well. I just thought that was kind of funny.
When is Pastor Carr leave?
Probably the 9th of November. So the 8th of November will be the last Sunday. I'm not sure that that is set in stone. Some of these things kind of stay up. But I think that it's going to be very quickly. So he will do a great job down there. That congregation has been flat on its back for a decade. And it has a wonderful location. It has a beautiful facility, and the men, especially John, my Alzheimer's again, John from San Jose, well, his wife ran the women's pastor's wife's retreat, John, his son is Thrivent Guy. Can't remember
Monkey.
The last name. Monkey, thank you. Jeez. Names. John Monkey spent several months there in Clovis and really rallied the congregation together in a vacancy, now I mean an interim term, did an excellent job. And so I have I'm confident that the congregation will grow strong and anchor our southern flank of our Sierra Circuit.
Is Pastor Monkey retired?
Yes.
He's retired.
Yeah, he's been retired for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for some time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pastor Bork took his place. He was the principal of California Lutheran High School, took the call to San Jose. San Jose may start a high school in their own facility. They have. I think at one of the congregations, perhaps, you know, there's
one north there.
Well, there's Santa Clara, is really declined over the years, but there's a facility there, so it may meet there. That's pretty tentative. They're just thinking about that, but they're thinking about it pretty seriously. So, possible that would be closer than down south. But still would require somebody to stay with someone, you know, if they wanted to go. So we'll see what happens there. So,